the 30 minutes is over that we were given by the chairperson. We are now going to start. I just want to check if Mr. Mgoti, are you ready? Ready. Honorable Magon, are you ready? You ready? Okay. Then we are going to start. And honorable members, I'm asked by other honorable members that we must be reminded that it's Valentine's Day. So therefore, they've got somewhere to go to. But I'm still open until 2 o'clock morning, the usual time of knocking off. Thank you, honorable Magon.
Thanks, Chair. Chair, I've had a good Valentine's Day already, so I'm also quite happy to sit here until 2 o'clock. I'm in no hurry to leave Parliament today. Chair, firstly to the Exaro Board, thank you for being here. And that we share similar ideals, because that's what this committee is all about, and that's why this committee is Team South Africa. It's about bettering the lives for those that come after us and for those who suffer the most at the moment. And that's why I'd like to ask you, and some of the questions might even be your opinion, but I want to remind you that you're under oath here. So what you say here, you are protected in saying. So you mustn't worry that you're going to say something here and someone's going to sue you for defamation of character or anything like that. As long as what you say here is in your mind the truth and you give your opinion, you are completely protected, because I am going to ask some questions that will require you to give an unbiased expert opinion. I want to start off by saying I'm a politician. And I think after lawyers, we're probably the most hated. In fact, I don't know, maybe we are the most hated profession. But that means I'm not a mining expert in any way, shape, or form. But I do understand certain issues around mining that affect entities for which I and my committee members exercise oversight, and we do so, you know, with a constitutional mandate. So I've learned things that I never thought I would learn. And one of the things that I learned was I learned about coal quality and why certain mines mine coal that's of different qualities and why certain power stations are built that require different qualities of coal. So, well, I know this. It's not on record. So could you tell me, for example, at the Medupi power station, where you provide coal, what is the coal quality required to burn at the Medupi power station? What grade of coal do we need to burn at the Medupi power station?
Thank you, Honorable Mazwane. The spec of the coal, or let me put it this way, the design of the power station was designed on the understanding of what's on the ground, and it's not the other way around. So you will design a boiler to meet the suitability of the coal that's there. And therefore what you will find is that if you look at the boiler of my timber power station, and the boiler at the Mpumalanga power station may not be the same, because the qualities and the geologies of those areas are very different. And therefore, you will find that in my timber power station, you will burn a coal that has got a high ash, and there will be a tolerance on what the sulfurs could be and also what the CV can be. And so, and also what you've also got to remember is that the geology in itself is not homogeneous. It's just not uniform. You know, you're going to be mining that for over 50 years and each area may be different. And therefore, what you will find that in some instances, depending on where you are mining at that time, the geology at that particular point may be slightly bit different than the geology in a place that you mined 10 years ago. So when you do the initial surveying, you're almost taking an average of that, but it only becomes much more confirmed as you do more infield drilling, as you are preparing now your work to say now in the next 2 years we go in that area. So let's get much more visibility of that. So therefore, it will change depending. Some instances you'll have an area which has got a slightly higher sulfurs, and some areas may have slightly lower sulfurs. And what you try then to do is that as you are sequencing your mining, that you will then say, if you know that in that one particular area there's going to be a higher, let's say, a particular quality issue, you then say, well, let me go and mine this other part so that more of this other part so that I can blend these two. So the truth of the matter is that the geologists could end up with a sulfur in one area higher than another time.
Okay. So just so that we understand the picture, when you sign a contract with a company like Eskom, Eskom, from what I understand, undertakes to build a power station with certain parameters in which they will operate. Like you said, the boilers. So the boilers will have a parameter in which they can operate. And whoever they sign a coal deal with, they are also of the understanding that they work within a certain parameter. And they give an assurance of continued coal supply. So in other words, you have to give Eskom an assurance that should you reach a point where you, like you said, geologically, where the coal is no longer of a spec that falls within the Eskom parameter, you are able to source the coal from elsewhere at your own cost. That will then be of the quality required to fall within Eskom's parameter. So in other words, you play fairly against one another. You say, you're taking a risk on us, and we will adhere to fall within the parameters required by your station.
I think what's also important is that when you build these power stations, there's a tolerance level. So it's not an absolute. They are designed to say, well, it's a minimum of this and a maximum of that. That's how come even in the contract, it will talk about a minimum and a maximum. So that you, because they understand that there is always a variability within that specification, because they know that it's not a homogeneous. So in the instances, for instance, where in our contracts, where we may be hitting a very, let's say, a very challenging area from a quality point of view, that's why the penalties are there. Because it's an understanding that it will not always be 100%. And therefore, the penalties for whatever may be will then kick in to say, well, whether it's your CV, whether it's your ash, or whatever. But you cannot do that permanently. Then it becomes uneconomic. Then you'll probably have to import your own coal import some coal elsewhere to blend it so that you can come back to spec. So you will play those type of things. And that's how come in some instances, if you have mines which are in close proximity of each other, you can actually start doing blending of some of these coals to actually augment that.
Okay. Do you know of any mines that were given preferential treatment when it came to the paying of penalties? Because all of you, all mines at some point should have to pay a penalty for some reason. I mean, this is one of the questions where you have to answer, you know, from what you know. Do you know of any mines that were given preferential treatment when it came to paying a penalty?
Well, I don't know personally of those mines. I only know what is being alleged in terms of what I read. Because in actual fact, those are private, confidential information. I mean, we don't give, for instance, what our qualities. We don't publish them. But what I have heard is that there has been a situation where a big penalty of $2 billion
yes.
suddenly became a very small penalty. You know, now it must be something quite bad for you to have a penalty of $2 billion. I mean, your coal has to be really, really out of spec for a huge volumes to get a penalty like that. So the question then is, how is it that a penalty of $2 billion, but you're talking about the same mine, the same operation, but in somebody else's hand, it just becomes a much smaller penalty. I don't have an answer to that, but I'm aware that those things seem to have happened.
Yeah. Well, I can tell you that I've clearly we read the same publications, because I've also read that a $2 billion fine was reduced dramatically. And the only answer I can think of is either there was an instruction to lower the penalty, or someone forgot to put the comma in the right place, and that would make them an unfit chief financial officer, or certainly a delinquent member of the board, if a mistake like that was allowed to happen. But thank you for your answer. Now, when it comes to the prepayment, I asked the question to Minister Lynn Brown about was a prepayment done? And I received the answer that was misleading to Parliament. So I feel very personally offended by the fact that this prepayment was made and then denied, and so it continues. And I'm not, you know, I'm a member of Parliament, and I take a solemn oath that everything that I say in Parliament shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. And I expect everyone to offer the same courtesy to me. And when Minister Brown was here, and we had this interaction about her mistruth. It's interesting how politicians don't like to say the word lying. But the error in the answer that was given to me, she blamed her source, and she told me that her source of information was Anoj Singh, who was the CFO. And the CFO then blamed Mr. Machele Koko, who at the time was the CEO. And as you correctly mentioned, we've seen footage in this committee of the carte blanche interview where the prepayment was first denied, then proof was shown, and then, you know, a little bit of a return of memory came, and perhaps this payment was done. But I'd like just a plain, straight answer from you, because I want to make sure that I heard your answer to Advocate Venora clearly. It is not common practice for mines to be prepaid. So it's not something ESCOM does.
It is not something that we have either ever experienced, and it is not something that I know of any other companies that have contracts. If it's the same CSA that we have with ESCOM, apart from qualities and a few other things, they're normally standard contracts in terms of how they conduct those their business with the mining houses. So I have never seen a prepayment being done. I have never heard of a prepayment being done. And I can categorically say that the first time I heard about it, as I indicated earlier, was when in that carte blanche program, it was first mentioned. And I even remember we all were laughing about this thing and said, man, this is something new. I mean, we don't understand how this thing happens. And therefore, neither for capital, neither for coal.
Now, the company that you work for, I think it's fair to say that you're not a multi-million rand company, you're a multi-billion rand company. So, in your opinion, 659 million? A substantial amount of money?
That is a lot of money.
It's a lot of money. So it's not just us exaggerating this. I mean, I think, you know, even in a company like yours, 659 million is a lot of money. Do you think it would be possible as a minister or as a CFO or as a CEO that you wouldn't notice an amount of 659 million being moved around? Is it at all a possibility? And I mean, speaking strictly from your position as quite high up in a multi-billion rand company, do you think you would miss 659 million rand?
I would be fired.
You would be fired. I'd be fired too, believe you me.
I mean, our governance processes are such that those types of monies, there is somebody who has to be accountable at the end of the day. There's always accountability. Even within your delegations of authorities, there is always accountability. At the end of the day, at the end of the day, the buck stops with me as the CEO. I can try and... that's why they say you have to fall on your sword.
Mm.
Even if you didn't do it, but you have had to say, how could this have happened during your watch? Mm. And so therefore, part of what is your responsibility is to ensure that the governance structures that are in place in the organization are such that it can enable you to ensure that things like that don't happen. Because you've got a whole host of instruments to actually look at these things. You can, besides the delegation of authority, you've got your internal audit. You've got to say with your internal auditors, go out there, as you're doing your audit, find things for me. That's what I say to my internal auditors. Find things for me that are making you uncomfortable.
Mm.
Don't wait until you have to give me a formal audit report. I want you to come to me immediately and say, you know what, in this particular area, there are certain things that I'm not happy about that enables me to actually follow up on. Because in my position, I can't be everywhere. I don't know everything that is happening. But I'm relying on certain measures that you are putting in place to ensure that you can safeguard and minimize the risk insofar as things like those things happening.
So it's fair to say you would rely on your CFO to make sure that 659 million rand wasn't being transferred without anyone knowing.
Well, the truth of the matter, somebody has to sign it off.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And depending on your delegation of authority and number of that magnitude, definitely my CFO has to know about it. I definitely, as the CEO, have to know about it.
And if you had a stakeholder, I assume you would tell the stakeholder too.
Of course.
Yes. Okay. Let's move on. It's now a well-known fact, the now infamous Switzerland trip with Minister Zwane, where deals were negotiated and things were happening. And I read a very interesting article by who I consider to be a very good investigative journalist, and I read it this week. And in it, he claims that people within the Big Five, the mining Big Five, have said that Minister Zwane gave everyone an ultimatum. That Minister Zwane said, I will audit you, I will check every contract, I will check your water licenses, I will check your BEE ratings, I will check your gender adherence, I will check every staff contract you've had, I will make your life unbearable until such time as you agree to go the path that I have chosen. So now I'm asking a very direct question, and I can see your eyes getting big because this isn't an easy question to answer. But this is the time to tell us. Has anyone in your company ever been threatened, either by a minister, by a member of the public that owns a company, or by any relation to a senior politician?
Honorable member, the answer is we have never experienced that. I think the only thing that we have experienced, which is something that as an industry, even through the chamber, where the Section 54s, the unprecedented Section 54s that would close operations even when it was not as much warranted as they should be, we experienced that type of pressure. And we made it known to the DMR that that action and that activity was unwarranted. And it led to some of the mining houses even actually taking the DMR to court on the basis of lost earnings as a result of these closures. And we have systematically have asked our members to report to the chamber of any incidences of that nature that we experience collectively or individually, so that as a chamber we will deal with those directly with the ministry. And that is exactly what we have been doing.
Now, you see, I think you're being incredibly diplomatic. A Section 54, and as you said, unprecedented and unwarranted, sudden actioning of Section 54s, when they're not warranted, they're unprecedented. Would you not see that as a veiled threat?
I've got to differentiate between the right of the DMR to issue a Section 54. By the mere fact that it is law, it means that it has a purpose.
Mm.
It's the use and the abuse of that, that is what is not acceptable. And therefore, the instrument in itself is right, because otherwise, how do you actually manage safety incidences to go totally unchecked? And that's one of those instruments you use. But when you've got an incident where one LDV, as we call it, one of those small vans, has got the light, the one of the blinkers, is not working, and suddenly you stop a whole mine, and so now everyone of this has got to stop, and you're going to go and check everything, we're going to go and do training for everybody all over again, and the mine is stopped for 2 or 3 days because of that. That is an abuse of an instrument which was correctly designed.
So the law was designed for the correct purpose.
Yes.
Its implementation was abused.
That's right.
Okay. That's what I needed to hear. Now, Mr. Kokko was not only the CEO of Eskom, he was also the head of generation for a long time. And let's be honest, load shedding in our country brought our economy to its knees. It brought South Africa to its knees, and it saw an almost collapse of a very fragile economy as it stood. Now, some will say that load shedding, and given the information that we as a committee have received now recently, load shedding could have really been avoided, and that load shedding was in actual fact a created crisis. And I can't remember, I think it was perhaps Winston Churchill who said, you never waste a good crisis. Given the information that we have at hand here, and again, this is your opinion, do you think we could have avoided load shedding?
I think what one needs to ask themselves is, in the life of any power station, what are the critical things that you've got to do to ensure that that operation operates efficiently and effectively throughout its life? And part of that actually has to do with making sure that you do effective maintenance at the time that is required, so that at least you minimize your downtime of those operations. Now, without really knowing exactly what was happening, but it was very clear by what came out was that there was a huge backlog, maintenance backlog, on a lot of these power stations, which resulted in some of them having to actually be worked almost non-stop, and as a result, not sufficient maintenance was done. Now, I can neither say that that was designed by design, or what was the reason why effective maintenance was not done. But if you manage your business well enough, we run operations.